Thank you for joining us and welcome to another edition of Answers Network. I'm your host, Alan Cardoza. And for those of you that have been listening, sending in questions and comments, thank you so much. And please continue to help spread the word that every Monday from 11 a.m. to noon Pacific time, this show will bring on special guests that can inspire, educate, and in some cases, entertain, while bringing answers and options to making our lives happier, healthier, and more successful. And I'd really appreciate if you could all do me a big favor. Please forward one of our shows to your social media group and to someone you know who can benefit from a particular subject. This is one powerful way that we together can make a positive influence in the world. And I guarantee you that this subject that we're going to be talking about is something that all of us can benefit from. Our guest today, Rich Carr, stands at the forefront of redefining cognitive brain training. With a distinguished background in mass media and mass communications, military service, and notable contributions to Paul Allen's Director of Digital Media. As a prolific writer and sought-after speaker, Rich has seamlessly integrated various communication channels to achieve unparalleled market engagement. I believe Rich brings a fresh and enlightened perspective on our memories and experiences through the transformative power of his new book, Surprised, The Science and Art of Engagement. Rich, welcome to Answers Network.
Thank you so much, Alan. I'm pleased to be here, and so does Buddha sleeping here in the background. But good to be here.
Well, the sleep. we'll kick it up a notch.
We got the dog sleeping in the background. Just giving him a name.
Yes. Anyway, Rich. So in first of all, when we were talking offline, I was telling you that I'm a huge proponent of the importance of communication. So before we dive into this incredible topic, please share your journey that led you to this point in your career.
It literally has been communication the whole time. I just wasn't necessarily aware of it. Back in the late 70s, early 80s, I got into broadcast radio and was a DJ. The old school DJ with, LPs and reel-to-reel tape and stuff. And started out as an overnight DJ, and I just loved radio. I thought I couldn't even believe it really was a job, because I just enjoyed walking in every day, and everybody around me who worked at Boeing or something didn't enjoy going to work. And I absolutely loved it. Didn't even matter what hours. And as I grew in that particular profession, first as a DJ, then as a promotional director, making up the fun things that radio stations did, then sales by mistake, that's where things really started kicking in, because I was a promotion director, and my sales manager, I went to her and I says, "Hey, how come this promotion I came up with isn't on the air?" And she goes, "Well, nobody's sold it yet." And I said, "Well, can I do it?" And she goes, "Well, yeah, all you have to do is get somebody to agree to do this." And I said, "Well, sounds easy enough." So I made some phone calls, ended up signing Pabst Blue Ribbon Beer to sponsor this boat at a distributor. Because, again, I didn't look at it as sales. I thought I was putting his name on this radio station thing that we were going to promote and do all this fun stuff with. And then I got, like several weeks later, I got two checks on payday. One for my radio DJ job. This was mornings in Nashville, Tennessee. Hmm. And then I got this other check, which was a mistake. So I went to HR and I said, "Well, you gave me two checks. I'd rather keep this new one, but it's, I've obviously wrong." She goes, "No, that's your commission." I said, "Commission for what?" "For selling the promotion. You get a portion of how much money they get." And she goes, "And this is the first of three." So I ended up quitting my on-air job and went to sales, because it was way, way, way more lucrative. And that is where I started to realize that the words you say are precious on a radio, and done correctly can elicit an amazing response. That went on to the military service, that went on to then my professional life, where I was working for Clear Channel Communications. Mm-hmm. Eventually ended up in Portland, as you said, with Paul Allen's Rose City Radio Group. I was a director of digital there. And then on the day I got my largest check of my life, I mean, I couldn't even believe this one check was larger than like my very first year of working in commissions. And I was elated. And by the time I got home, I decided I didn't want the job anymore because it was only 7% of what I sold, not the other 93%. And so I started an agency, a marketing and advertising communications agency. And that too ended up going incredibly well. And got some great clients, some great local restaurants, ended up with the Seahawks, and then gradually went up to Nike and CVS and Aetna and the Veterans Administration, all based off of the way I did communication. And then the real paramount thing that happened, and this was 10 years ago, about 10 years and a month ago, my daughter and I were going to a rodeo. We were both rodeo performers. She's a barrel racer, and I was a heeler to my son's header, team roping. Great, beautiful day, September 1st. And somewhere around noon, a lady was distracted in her driving, ran a stop sign, and T-boned my daughter and I riding my Harley because my son was following with the truck and the horses. She hit us about 45 miles an hour and threw us some 60 feet. We were fortunate. We both survived. We landed in a large drainage ditch out in the country. And it was actually horrible. I mean, she broke a number of bones, concussion, hip. And I had my right arm avulsed. My right leg ended up being amputated. I wasn't aware of all this because I was kind of out. And my brother was POA at the time. And anyway, as I was recovering, I was in the hospital for a couple months. I remember they took me into the support room. The first time I got into a wheelchair, they brought me into the support room. And in this room, there's probably 30, 40 other people, some more buggered up than I was, some less. And they sat me next to this guy, also missing his right leg, in a wheelchair. And he was enormous, like 3-4 times my size. And I'm 6'2", 220. A big man. And he was all wedged into this group, this chair. And I just thought, oh, my God, my life is over. This is what's up for me. And I asked to get out of the room. They wouldn't let me out of the room. That went on for a while. And then on the TV that was on the wall, there was some sort of sporting event. And as I looked closer, it was actually Olympic track or some sort of a big time track. And it was the Paralympics. And it ends up the guy running also missing his right leg. It was there. I remember looking at the TV and looking at the guy to my left, looking at the TV guy to the left. And I thought, well, I want to be the guy on the TV.
Right.
And from that moment on, I decided to find out what true communication actually was, how new information was processed in the brain so that it would work 100% of the time. Because my goal was to walk again, to not be this guy in the chair to the left of me. And in the hospital, I had a Surface tablet and I could voice search, and I got into neuroscience and then the cognitive learning neuroscience. And then I was introduced to Dr. Kiran Omani, who was a learning scientist at the University of Washington, And we became fast friends, and he had been studying this particular thing for the last 40 years. He's originally from Ireland. And I thought, boy, if I could make this English to where everybody would understand it, we would have a going Jesse here. This would be something that people would really want to know versus what we know as behaviorism, meaning do this, do that. And this was cognitivism, to where it actually made people think. And long story short, we published that research in the form of our first book called Brain-Centric Design, the Surprising Neuroscience Behind Learning with Deep Understanding. And it was that methodology that took me from what I just described to, if you saw me today, most people wouldn't realize it. I'm actually in better shape than I've ever been. I'm 61 now. And so long as I'm fully clothed, you know, I've got a good gait. I'm steady. I go to a lot of chiropractors. I don't do like medical drugs. I'm pretty holistic in the way I've tried to do this. And in fact, My first chiropractor to do an upper cervical is just down the street from you in Mission Viejo. So anyway, hello, Dr. Liz Hafer at Well Connected Cairo. She really, her and a number of other chiropractors kind of got all the bones back in shape. And I started having this realization that the brain's a lot more powerful than I thought it was. And in the book, because of the book, we do certification classes of different sorts every month. And a number of chiropractors started coming through the classes. And it was there that I realized they were actually the true brain doctor. What chiropractors do isn't back cracking or bone cracking. They clear neural pathways so that all your organs can speak with high fidelity to all your other organs. Mm-hmm. And this just started a pure love of communication, realizing that it's all managed by electricity and chemicals, which are prefaced by thought. And if you can order those pieces of information in the right order, at the right amount, at the right time, you'll have communication. So to simplify that, the brain, your brain, my brain, everybody who's listening's brain is the same brain, and it's the same processing system. Now, there may be different memories or different things in the middle of your brain, this limbic system, you know, the history of your world, but mm-hmm. how new information gets in and becomes permanent is the same breadcrumbs with 99.9% of the people in the world. And that is what brain-centric design was about, which led to the second book, Surprised. Brain-centric design was the science of it. Surprise was the application of that science of it. And it's just been a beautiful journey with realizing my old boss, Paul Allen, you know, he put millions into the Seattle Brain Institute. Mm-hmm. And it's only in the last 15, 20 years that we've actually realized that all these Latin and Italian named parts in this 3 pounds of goop actually had functions that we could manage with thought. And since then, it's just been a party, kind of waking up every day and enjoying what I do and working with who I work with, because it works 100% of the time. It's literally how to find the potential in your own thought and help others find theirs.
I absolutely love that. And while you were saying it, the thought came to my mind, how do we get this into our school system? How do we get this to children at an early age?
Almost the number one question. And Dr. Omani, when this thing really started happening, which was of all times in COVID, because in COVID, we were already online doing this with Nike and every country in the world mm-hmm. and a number of other people. And he decided to go the K-12 route. That was his passion. He would wake up in the morning to fix beautiful baby brains, as he said. And he is. He's global. And it is getting into the school system. It just wasn't there to put in the school system before. So nobody's been shortchanged. The knowledge just hasn't been available or consumable in the way it is now. So he's got a series of book called Brain-Based Classrooms, which is replacing a lot of curriculum. He started out with three teachers as his disciples, so to speak, and now he has thousands upon thousands. And he's working on governmental sized changes in his native Ireland, in India, and we're working on that in the United States. I took the business route and decided to work with the Nikes and the CVSs of the world. His passion was purely beautiful baby brains.
Well, I just cannot tell you how happy I am to hear that.
Yeah, me too. I mean, I was a homeschooler, and everybody, I mean, I homeschooled my kids.
Yeah.
But everybody does a lot of brain-centric design intuitively. Mm-hmm. I mean, you'll do something and you'll feel it. You know when it happens, but you can't replicate it. And if I were to make an analogy of this particular science and put it into the kitchen, there's cooking and there's baking. Like I'm a cook. Cook, you can get up in the stove, glass of wine, put on the music, put a little bit of this, a little bit of that, and create a dish. Baking, if I want to make that perfect focaccia, I have to do the right ingredients in the right amount at the right time. And that's how the brain processes information. So it is literally a recipe of how to get past the amygdala, or Amy G. Dalla, as I call her, sometimes the bouncer of Club Brain. I have a lot of analogies for her. But if I can get past her, which is part of this whole model, then I actually give my brain an opportunity to think, because people don't realize this. And this is stuff that I've just found out in the last 10 years, but we spend 80% of our lives in the reactive brain, meaning it didn't get past the amygdala, meaning we're just doing what other people do or what our habits tell us to do or what we've always done because that's all we know. And so we react. The key to cognitive thinking is not reacting. It's thinking. Because here's the deal, Alan. I mean, this is not meant to sound profound, but it kind of is. For most people listening, they've never been taught to think. Mm-hmm. They've only been told to think, and typically what to think of. So we're a reactionary beast in a behaviorist model, in the way we've been brought up in school, you know, which is basically compliance. Comply and I'll give you a lump of sugar. Comply and you get a gold star. Comply and you get an A. Comply and I'll give you better office. But now AI kicking in, suddenly compliance, especially if it's iterative compliance, is being replaced by technology, machines, robots, so on mm-hmm. and so forth. And the true currency in any workplace is thought. If you can think, if you can innovate, if you can question, or even with AI, if you can write a dynamite prompt better than the next guy, you're going to win. And that is only through cognition, which is brain-centric design and surprise. That's what we do.
You know, I want to share a story about one of my sons that I think touches on exactly what you just said. I've shared it before, but any opportunity to brag about one of my own kids is a good one. So when my son was 14 years old, and he had excelled in school up to that point, and all of a sudden he wasn't excelling in school, and I was being called in to meet with the powers to be at the school. He was in public school at this time, and so I had gotten some texts from him the day before that he said, "Dad, I want you to buy this piece of property in Africa." And I'm like, "What?" He goes, "Well," he said, "it's struck by lightning like over 2,000 times a week," and he said, "So I've done some research, and there's a stream underneath it." And he said, "I think that we can take this electricity and we can house it. We can put it in the water. The water goes to the city or the town, the closest town." He says, "They don't have much electricity there." He said, "I would need to set up a way to harness it and put it in batteries or do something like," he said, "get somebody like Elon Musk involved, you know, and house this." And he said, "And then we could provide electricity for this town, you know," and he puts in, he goes, "you know, and we can make some money." So he's 14 years old. So the next day I have to go to the school, and I'm meeting with quite a few people from the school that are telling me that he's not doing well in school. And they said, "But don't worry." They said, "Because we've come up with a solution. We're going to move him in with the slow kids, and he'll feel more comfortable with them." "Excuse me," I said, "let me read you a text." And then I read them that text. And they all just froze for a moment. And I said, "Don't worry." I said, "Don't get uncomfortable." I said, "It appears to me that instead of somebody that needs to be with the slow kids, he's somebody who's thinking so much while..." Oh, by the way, I left out a little part. When he was sending me those texts the day before, and at one point, as we're texting back and forth, and I go, "Wait a minute, aren't you supposed to be in school?" And then, you know, oops. And I said, "He's sitting in your class, and he's figuring out ways to bring electricity to people that don't have it." I said, "So rather than have you worry about this," I said, "I'll be taking him out of school. I've already met with a Fusion Academy that's a one-on-one teaching program that is taking off across the country, and where he'll be able to take that thinking and use it to do good." And I walked out. But I think that that's an example of what you're talking about from the standpoint, are they being told or indoctrinated into just doing what they're told versus do they want to think about how they can make a difference in the world? And obviously, you and I want to see everybody doing the second one.
Absolutely. You know, and a lot of it has to do with the environment. I can't just blame it all on public schools and their methodology. And even though they buy 10 years worth of curriculum at a time, and nothing's going to move fast in that situation. And if you're going to be a parent, be a parent. And there's always a way to homeschool, especially now. Mm-hmm. And the beautiful thing about it is what happens isn't just that you're helping them think, it's the environment that they're in. And this is a big part of what we do when we're speaking with people is that environment, I guess, nicely in business, they call it psychological safety. What that really means is the environment where you can be yourself. So obviously your child can be his self around dad or mom or in the home. Certain businesses who understand psychological safety, they have better employees because the employee can come in and it's not that I have to learn everything about your background or your culture or any of that stuff, because I won't, no matter what. I mean, you might give me some HR precursor that says, here's this, and it's not going to be internalized. However, if you can walk into an environment and be yourself, work or home or play, it's like when you see an old buddy from school you haven't seen for 20 years, instantly you're you again versus you in a corporate environment. There's a study from a fella named Thomas Boyce called The Orchid and the Dandelion, which is the root of all of our training, because a person will come into an environment and each of us has different what's called autonomic nervous system reactivity. Or it's a big word, ANS sometimes is how it's referred to, but it basically means how you react to the world around you. Like, I don't like to be in Costco, a big giant building, lots of people, no doors. And I'm not claustrophobic. I've just been in crowd control situations where I don't like big crowds with no way out, for lack of it. And we all have those things, whatever they might be. But in his study, the orchid and the dandelion, he basically breaks up, and he has all the data to show this. It's neuroscience. All the data to show it is that there's two kinds of people. There are orchids, much like the flower, and dandelions, also like the flower. Now, the dandelion is resilient. The dandelion grows in cracks in the sidewalk, in the snow, in the middle of the street. Dandelion grows anywhere. And if you look at a person that way, that's the kind of person that basically no matter what you shove at them, they're fine. You know, they'll adjust. They'll be cool. An orchid, and this has nothing to do with intelligence, an orchid is highly, highly vigilant in most social situations. So I might be an orchid and walk into your class and I'm with my best buddy, a dandelion, and you give me a scowl when we lock in because for whatever reason, you give me a scowl. The dandelion's going to go, whatever, Alan scowled. The orchid's going to go, he hates me. He's always hated me. He doesn't trust me. Something's wrong. And is going to sit there and perseverate on that kind of information, which means you're in your reactionary brain, back to the amygdala. Right. If you're in your reactionary brain, you can't internalize new information. You can't learn algebra by being chased by a lion. You've got to feel comfortable. Right. And if I broke it down into the eight basic emotions, there's only two emotions where you can actually internalize information. The first one is joy or fun or happiness. Mm-hmm. And the next one is surprise. All the other ones, boredom, stress, worry, concern, entrapment, you can't learn. So if you're walking into a class where the teacher gives you the guzz eye and you're an orchid, you'll sit there and you'll nod your head, but you didn't take anything home. You know, if you're a dandelion, you'll do enough to get pat by. And it's an amazing situation where now in the corporate world, what businesses are understanding is that comfort level, not that you're going to rule with an iron thumb. It's not like Cialdini's book, Influence, which is purely behaviors. It's a seminal work, but it's actually some of the stuff that you learn in there now is what puts you in an HR department. And it's all based off of manipulating, not all, it's heavily based on manipulating behavior, not on getting people to think and actually growing in the situation. And this isn't soft PC stuff. it's, if you just think about your own brain, when, like, if you're doing a hobby, say, I'll use that hobby, is something you love, and you meet, you go to a hobby group, you'll be just fine in the hobby group because everybody's just grooving on what's in the hobby group, or you're just enjoying learning so you can articulate that information. But if you're told to memorize these 38 things before 5 o'clock and it's 80% of your grade, you'll tank, you know? And so it's just understanding the difference of behaviorism and cognitivism, or compliance versus thinking, and mining that thinking, because the economy of the future for humans anyway is going to be prefaced off that if you want higher earning potential.
All right. We're speaking with Rich Carr. His book is Surprised, The Science and Art of Engagement. We're going to take a break. We'll be right back. Stay with us. You're listening to or watching Answers Network.
Conflict International are experts at uncovering the truth. Our specialist team has decades of experience in providing a range of bespoke investigation and intelligence services to companies and individuals. Whether you need professional screening or background checks of employees, due diligence of potential clients or business partners, asset tracing services, or surveillance, Conflict International has a rapid response team on hand to get you to the heart of the matter. Our key strength is in our global capabilities. We can tap into an extensive network of trusted professional investigators based in most jurisdictions worldwide, enabling us to go almost anywhere a case takes us. Conflict International has decades of experience with a diverse range of skills among our team, developed from backgrounds in military and security intelligence services, as well as practice lawyers. Visit our website today at conflictinternational.com to find out more about our services. That's conflictinternational.com. Global reach, local knowledge.
And we're back. We are talking about communication. And so, Rich, let's get into the book part of this. Can you share some specific example or examples from the book that illustrates the transformative power of Surprised in shaping our memories and our experiences?
Absolutely. And it's, I thank you for asking that, because Surprised is that, again, an emotion. We're an emotional machine, so these dictate a lot of the things that we do. And surprise is one of the big eight. It is the only one where your entire body pays attention to whatever it is for a millisecond. And the millisecond that follows that point is the most valuable point in all communication. Go ahead.
Rich, let me interject something, because when you said that, I'm a new grandpa. Okay. And which also is like one of the greatest things ever. And the granddaughter is now 9 months old, and she, for the longest time, she's starting to get other emotions, but she had two facial emotions, and it was either joy or surprise. So is there something to that? I've never thought of it until you just mentioned this being part of eight key things. Is there a reason why it's those two? And it's hilarious to me, because she'll go from one to the other like that.
Yes, absolutely. And it's a great observation. Everything we remember is shaped by a surprise. Everything. And the reason is, at that moment when you have surprise, it's your brain, and specifically around the amygdala. Again, I call her Amy G. Dalla. We actually have two amygdalae. They're about the size and shape of an almond. And way back when they were dissecting brains, the Latin or Italian fellow, it's actually Latin. Amygdala is Latin for almond, because it's shaped like an almond. But at that point of surprise, the new information, whatever sense it's coming in, visual, audibly, taste, touch, however that's being observed, gets to the amygdala. The whole brain focuses on that instance for a moment right at that time and decides whether it's going to be pushed in the reactionary brain or into the thinking brain. And that's that moment where the two emotions happen, and one's cataloged as good and one's cataloged as bad. So if all of a sudden your grandchild, you know, is surprised and looks at you with a smile, well, you made it past the amygdala. You know, if surprised and doesn't, back to the reactionary brain. And it's literally building the brain. It's literally building the child's programming system of what is a good thing and what is a bad thing. And that's that moment of surprise where that decision in your brain is made. Is this good for me right here, right now? Well, then it's into the rest of the brain. If it's something that's not good for me, boredom, stress, worry, concern, entrapment, I'm going to react to it versus internalize it. It's that simple.
Wow. Anyway, I'm just amazed. So let's, again, what would be some examples that you have, just some specific examples from the book that kind of illustrates that transformative power?
Well, the beautiful thing about surprise is that it's not just a thing. There are general surprises and there are specific surprises. And a general surprise might be a pleasant surprise or a neutral surprise or a foreshadowed surprise. You know, we use that in media all the time. Stay tuned. You won't want to miss this thing coming up. Foreshadowed surprise.
The teaser.
Teaser, as we call it. Tease. And then there's a number of, like, say, specific surprises. And these are surprises for effect. And what I mean by that is you might have a personal surprise or a narrative surprise or use a surprise to get somebody's attention to make them pay attention to the next thing. Like I was reading this thing in National Geographic where they're in Italy and they're excavating by the volcano and they find this 2,000-3,000-year-old vat of honey and they pull the lid off that honey. It's 3,000-year-old honey, still 100% edible, which is a surprise. And so when you're speaking, the goal is to make your words stick around like that honey. I use surprise there from a National Geographic article to one you're going, where's he going with this? Then you hear the fact that the honey is edible after 3,000 years, like the world's perfect food, and then bring it back to what we're talking about. That would be a narrative surprise. Just taking something, answering your question, but using a surprise to have you pay just a little more pay a little more attention because you're going, why is he suddenly talking about National Geographic and Italy and honey? It's just a way of planning communication. The surprising thing about communication to me now that I've studied it to the point I've studied it and used it in the military and professional life and personal life, obviously, is the fact that most communicators don't know what they're communicating. They might be the subject matter expert, and they could talk about it all day long, but they don't have a big idea, meaning I'm going to say all this stuff to Alan and I want him to walk away with this. They don't go that far. They just start riffing on information and telling you all this stuff. And you as a human are somehow supposed to take all that information and get whatever it is you're supposed to get out of it. And if the person communicating doesn't know what they're communicating, doesn't have what we call the big idea, what the learner walks away with, and what two things they must know to walk away with that thing, then they're just making noise. Because again, the brain has rules. And one of them is the most cited paper in all of psychology called Miller's Law. And we all probably rolled through this in high school or college, but Miller's Law is a paper called 7 + or -2. The magical number 7 + or -2, meaning that your brain can handle 7 + or -2 concepts at any given time. This was a study done in 1956. They redid this study in the early 2000s with a much larger sample size and with the technology of the day to put it all together versus pencil and paper back in 56. Ends up the number is 4 + or -2, meaning that if I'm speaking to you and I want to get all these points across, on a good day, you might get 6 of them, on a bad day, 2. So what we preface all of our conversation with in surprised is that your big idea is only supported by 2 scaffolding thoughts because you're not going to remember more. You might, like I say, on a good day, remember 6, but chances are if you're listening to this interview, you might be thinking about work, that letter you got from the IRS, who's going to be president, my dog is sick, my kid's getting in trouble at school. These are thoughts that occupy our working memory where this 4 + or -2 takes place, how much stuff you can keep track of. So everything that we preface in brain-centric design and in surprise is no more than two things with one deliverable.
Now, does this tie into, and I know that like I'm as guilty as anybody. The very young me was very proud of the fact, and I thought that I could multitask tons of things. And then as I started to learn more about the brain and as a psych student, started to realize that what I thought I was proud of was actually not real. Yeah. Is this along those same lines when the reality is that you can't really multitask that many things, or you start to get to a point in which of a diminished return?
Yeah. Yeah. Actually, we call it multi-switching. That's all it is. Okay. You're not multitasking. You're just multi-switching, not paying all of your focus on one item. You're just switching from one to another. And there's a recoup time that makes that ineffective. Like there is some people in the world, like 0.0038% or something to that, that can literally multitask. But everybody listening is a multi-switcher and shouldn't fool themselves with that, because it's something you can't do. And you can't rely on memory either. I mean, memory is flawed, heavily flawed. That's why we have primacy and recency rules. You know, you can sit there and tell me Alan's 10 steps to success, and I'll remember the first and the last, the middle stuff. Information that fast. The brain wants an answer quick. The brain wants the easiest answer. The brain wants the most beneficial thing for that person right here, right now. It really only has two primary purposes in our lives, and the brain I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. The first one is to keep us alive. Heartbeat, you know, body temperature, all that kind of stuff. And the second one is to help us thrive. We literally love to learn. We're curious beasts. Yeah. But going back to that school system, we get blown away around first grade, because up until that point, you know, kindergarten, I could finger paint, didn't matter. Rich, good job. You know, what is it? Didn't matter. First grade, suddenly I wasn't in the lines. I used the wrong blue. I didn't follow the instructions the way the teacher wanted me to. And I slowly get pushed into this mold of compliancy of whatever series of teachers happen to do with me. I mean, there's good teachers and bad teachers, but they're in that system where it ends with an assessment. So if I think about it, what we already talked about, if let's say I'm an orchid, I'm a highly sensitive person in social places, and my dog is sick and my sister caught my hair on fire that morning. When I'm in your class and I'm supposed to read Jack and Jill Runs Up the Hill, I'm not there. And right. Suddenly they give me a test on Jack and Jill, and I don't answer them right because I'm worried about my sister and her lighter or my dog getting sick. And I take this test and I don't get anything right. Suddenly that teacher grades me. I failed. I'm a young kid, and an adult is saying, you're a failure. And all I was worried about was my sister and my dog. The school system doesn't react for those things. I mean, it just, I was not there to pay attention to you, teacher. I was there because I'm supposed to be in school, but I have all this other stuff going on. None of that really gets taken into consideration. And I'm talking about a young kid here, but at work, same kind of thing. You haven't been yourself this week, Alan, you know, we're going to put you on watch. Well, you know, you've got things going on in your life, but that isn't part of that situation, that learning brain. And brain has to be in a state of joy or pleasant surprise to take on new information. And me being told I'm an idiot because I couldn't remember Jack and Jill is no reason to put me in the slow kids class. It just means I had a bad day.
Right. or I'm bored to death with whatever it is you're teaching today.
Oh, that's the thing. I mean, my son was the same way. I mean, they told me, we went in there and I remember started off wrong, teacher conference. I said, oh yeah, I'm Jesse Carr's dad, you know, here for the teacher conference. Teacher says, okay, which one's Jesse? Strike one.
Wow.
They had four teachers. They called the dream team. You know, they brought out the wall so all the kids would rotate. Damn teacher didn't even know my kid's name. Second of all, said he was having problems reading. And at home, I lived on a horse ranch and a farm. He could read Chilton manuals, you know, how to fix engines and things. That interested him. Jack and Jill Running Up the Hill did not interest him.
Exactly.
That's all. And in learning, here's a real simple rule. feed the appetite, not mm-hmm. your appetite, their appetite.
Their appetite.
So your child, 14 years old, studying lightning strikes, you know, and not only does it conduct electricity, there might be diamonds there too, and it will hook up Elon yeah. Musk, and we'll square this thing away. That's a beautiful story, because that's not Jack and Jill. Mm-hmm. That is cognitive thought, untethered, fun. He's helping humanity. I mean, what a journey you could feed him on, you know, hey, let's go to the science museum and see how that whole thing works locally. And you can work in stuff like geography yep. and math. I mean, we did that on the farm where I remember when we were doing the area in geometry, I told them they had to, now that we're going to take a break, we're going to go clean 144 square feet of stall. And of course they first were 144 square feet. Come on, we just learned that. How many stalls do we have to clean? You mean one stall? Yeah. One stall.
Yeah.
Suddenly, you know, now they learned versus, you know, a big data sheet of stuff that I'm supposed to give answers to.
Yep, absolutely. Now, for everybody out there, the book is Surprise, the Science and Art of Engagement. And before we take another break, there's something that is unique in regards to this book. And Rich, I'm going to ask you to elaborate a little bit about it. But the book promises access to an online portal with additional resources. So, Rich, if you can kind of elaborate on what readers can expect to find in this exclusive portal.
It's multiple perspectives. That's the short answer. Because again, that's how we learn. Somebody tells us one thing, and then we see another thing, and then we experience another thing, and our brain puts these pieces together. Now, the book is a book. You know, you have to read the book. That's one perspective. You go online, suddenly you're part of some interactive videos and some exercises, and you're involved or invited to one of our certification classes. The idea is to give you multiple perspectives on everything. Because if I try chili at Alan's house, then that's going to be my one perception of chili. But if I go to this restaurant and a friend of mine, and I used to manage Telemundo in Palm Springs, you know, and suddenly I'm going more chili, multiple perspectives, I realize chili is much more than what Alan served me. Chili is this whole thing that people interpret mm-hmm. in their own ways. So when you go online, the idea is to show you that multiple perspectives will increase your chance of comprehension and keeping that forever and giving you a number of those perceptions or perspectives so that you can have fun doing it. And one of them is a seven session video of a story called Insightsville. And it literally takes you through the seven levels of surprise, because even though we call it one emotion, there's actually a lot of things that happen on in the brain that you can control. In any mm-hmm. kind of presentation, so it shows you how to do that in a number of different ways.
All right, folks, we're speaking with Rich Carr. Stay with us. We're going to take another break. We'll be right back. You're listening to or watching Answers Network.
Having a teenager at risk who is going through a traumatic experience can be difficult on parents, siblings, and all who are working with that young person. No family should have to go through this process alone. West Shield Adolescent Services is here to ensure you don't have to. Many of the psychologists and psychiatrists we work with have spoken about the stress families go through. Not just the young person, but the parents, needing to get their child to a program where they can get the help they need. West Shield aims to lessen that stress. Every case goes through a thorough intake process with one of our knowledgeable, compassionate intake coordinators. We want to know the likes, the dislikes, and the fears of each child. This important information is taken into consideration when choosing the best suited team member for each individual teenager. West Shield agents come from all different walks of life, giving us a diverse group of team members to ensure a personalized, compassionate experience for every teenager. This allows us to make certain every young person we work with gets to the chosen program in the best possible state of mind. We contacted over 600 of the youth we've worked with in the past to see where they're at now. 97% of these individuals told us how much their lives had improved, that they had better relationships with their friends and families, had gone on to marry, have kids, and were now using the skills they learned in their program to raise their own children. Our role of transporting at-risk teenagers is a vital step in the process of ensuring a youth's ability to thrive in their new environment, and is a role we don't take lightly. The recovery process can be a long one, but like any journey, it started with a single step.
And we're back. You're watching or listening to Answers Network. Our guest is Rich Carr, and we are talking about his new book, Surprised, The Science and Art of Engagement. Now, Rich, I know that the book emphasizes that sort of a ripple effect of understanding the whole concept of surprise. How do you envision this impacting individuals, communities, and even the workplace?
Positively would be the short answer.
Good.
Well, you know, I'll give you an example, Alan. Well, and you can use it with your kids, with your coworkers, with your spouse or partners, whatever. But it is using the word to get them past their amygdala at any time. And so let's just say your child comes home from whatever he comes home from, and he's ranting and raving about something. And you being a good father, you're just sitting there and you're grunting a lot, you know, kind of like I remember back in the day, I read men are from Mars, women are from Venus.
Yeah.
And that's a superpower of males, be able to grunt and not say anything and try to fix it. So you do that kind of thing. And after he's kind of gone through the first wave of whatever this negative emotion is or whatever the emotions are, you ask them one simple question. And the question is, what was surprising?
Okay.
That question always gets the same re-answer from whoever you're asking it for. First of all, they'll pause. Typically, they'll look up or maybe just around, and then they say the truth. Because when you ask what was surprising, you didn't give them directions on how to answer it. Tell me what was the worst thing today. How did he do that? You know, those are pointed questions.
Exactly.
What was surprising is going to elicit the response from that person that was surprising to them, not what you wanted to hear from them, but what was surprising to them. And it might be something small. It might be something large. It might be a eureka moment where all of a sudden they say something. It's like, oh, had I known. But what was surprising is the question I love to give everybody after you speak to somebody or they're talking about some kind of troubled thing or new thing in their life, because that'll get down to what I call the heart of the dog. I mean, suddenly they're giving you the truth. What was surprising? Well, I'll tell you what was surprising, you know, and then suddenly they go on with what the crux of that was. At first, it was just them reporting on how upset they were or what happened and so on and so forth to vent, to get it out because they can talk to you. But if you ask that question, what was surprising, not what was the most surprising thing or what was surprising about that, because again, that narrows down their answer. What was surprising? Kid comes home from school, has a great day. Tell me about your day. What was surprising? Oh, Jimmy had this butterfly thing, you know, I mean, suddenly they're talking about their passion and it gives you the opportunity to hop on that passion train rather than trying to fix it or tweak it or put your two cents in, because each one of us has our perception on anything. You have your perception on school. I have my perception on school, but it's just our perception and nobody has the same perception as me or you. We went to different schools, different things, different everything. Yep. What was surprising to you is equally as different. I shouldn't be expecting a particular answer when I say what is surprising. I expect what was surprising from you, and that's something we can talk about and keep somebody in a safe space in their head.
I love it. It's very similar to when my boys were little, and I would hear other parents ask questions a little differently, and it would be like, oh, so how was your day? And they'd go fine and they'd walk away. And I thought, well, that's not getting us anywhere. So mine were more like, so what was the most exciting thing that happened today? And the next day it might be, you know, what was the, and I wish I would have thought of surprise because I like that, but, I would try to give it something to where you couldn't give a one-syllable answer. Yeah, that was kind of my goal at that time. You know, I'm looking, I can't believe we are out of time.
Really?
First of all, I'd love to be able to talk again, to have you back. It's funny, you mentioned John Gray. John Gray's been on the show 3 times. I love him. I love his books and the information that he brings. But what would be just kind of a final takeaway that you would love readers of Surprised to walk away with?
Well, that's a great question. I would say a couple things, you know, but probably one of my favorite things for most people is to say, be predictable, consistent, and kind.
I love it.
Just move through life being predictable, consistent, and kind. And even though predictable and consistent sounds not consistent with surprise, right?
Yeah.
The wonderful thing about predictable, consistent, and kind is that it keeps people safe when they're around you, safe thinking. Now, I might be in my predictability full of surprises,
mm-hmm.
and I am, but that's what you expect from Rich. I mean, so it's just a rule of walking through life to where if you want everything to be Jake, then work on yourself first and serve yourself up in the same way and be kind, which is much different than nice. You know, yeah. Nice person wouldn't say you have food stuck in your teeth. A kind buddy would, so that he wouldn't worry about others' and reactions.
No, that's a great point. And I would say, when you were saying that, I was thinking, and a kind person would, but not while you're at the table with 20 people.
Yeah, or they might, you know, because I know you real well, I might kind of go like this.
Exactly.
Touch my teeth or something. But that's a kind person. They're sparing you a lot more grief rather than you worrying about what they might think if I say something about whatever I was going to say something about. So I'd say predictable, consistent, and kind. And, you know, a lot of your life will be pretty well licked because people, birds of a feather, you know, flock together. And if you're that kind of person, people are going to gravitate to that because we like to be safe.
Well, Rich, thank you so much again. And thank you for doing what I believe that many of the people we bring on this show is. You're making a positive difference in the world. And for that, I am very grateful.
Well, thank you so much for the opportunity to stand on your platform and visit about it. It means a great deal to me as well.
All right. Thank you. For everybody out there, if you like what you hear, please leave a review. It'll help us reach more people. And I want you to know that we appreciate it. The next time you're on Instagram, Facebook, or X, please remember, stop by our page, check out some of our listings. And if you like them, please like us and spread the word. For everybody out there, be good human beings and be with us next week on Answers Network.
You're listening to Answers Network with Alan Cardoza, only on LA Talk Radio.